Thank you, Charles. You should know, though, that Charles is my official paid eulogist. Well, I think let me just add as a comment to his comments that Socrates says in one of the dialogues says, the greatest good that any human being can do to another is to refute him. And so I have simply been trying to do good. It's not always greatly appreciated, but I keep going on as best I can. If I was a preacher today, I would say that the text for my remarks today is taken from the current October issue of Commentary. There's a symposium. Has the Supreme Court gone too far? My best way of explaining my attitude to that question is a little story from World War II, one of my favorites. During the Blitz, when the bombs were falling on London, a little Cockney cab driver got out of his cab and shook his fist at the sky, which filled with the Luftwaffe, and said, that Hitler, one of these days he's going to go too far. I think that's all you need to know about the Supreme Court. Now, as some of you may know, among the people that I have engaged, not to his pleasure, is Robert Bork. And Bork made a contribution to this symposium, which connects. Which connects with the dispute that he and I have had over the years, particularly, I guess it was in the year that his book, The Tempting of America, was published, and I wrote a critique of it in National Review, and then the National Review editors, in their infinite wisdom, gave my book on original intent to Bork to review. I can best characterize his review as a temper tantrum. The thing that sort of set him off and that set me off in the first place was the fact that he explained that substantive due process is the technique that liberal justices use in order to invent the Constitution as they go along. And most of the things that he had to say in criticism of liberal judicial activism, we were in perfect agreement on that. But if you're going to accuse liberals of inventing the Constitution, you shouldn't do it yourself. And he found the first great example of liberal judicial activism, in Taney's opinion, in Dred Scott, in which he said Taney had invented a right to own slaves, which is nowhere in the Constitution. Now, it's difficult to imagine how anybody could read the Constitution of 1787 and not see the Fugitive Slave Clause. And there are several other major points. Now, it's also the case that Taney, in his opinion, had cited Article 1, Section 9, the Foreign Importation Clause, and the Fugitive Slave Clause as examples of how the framers of the Constitution had recognized and given authority and protection to the institution of slavery. Well, you can't complain about people not reading things into the Constitution if you read things out of the Constitution. And Bork just read the pro-slavery provisions of the Constitution of 1787 out of the Constitution. He wrote his review, and then I wrote a rebuttal to his review, and he replied to my rebuttal. And a good time was had by all. But the last word in his reply to me was a final, a grudging concession that yes, he did admit that the Constitution did give some protection to slavery. But he said, only in a few places. now I open the pages of the commentary and I read the following. The classic examples, this is of what he calls the miracles of transubstantiation, whereby the liberals invent rights which are not in the Constitution and then invent remedies for the Constitution, for the rights which they had invented. He says, the classic examples are, of course, Dred Scott, 1857, and Lochner, 1905. The one creating a right to hold slaves under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, how can the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1858, Dred Scott was 1857, and the 13th Amendment had abolished slavery. So he has Taney in 1857 discovering in the due process clause of the 14th Amendment a right which had already been abolished by the 13th Amendment. Now, it's not possible to defend conservative constitutionalism with that kind of, the most charitable way I can call it is loose thinking. Unfortunately, Bork is not alone in his simple disregard, you might say, of the Constitution in its original meaning. By and large, the principal defense which conservative constitutionalism has taken in opposition to the liberal judicial activism, which I suppose almost everybody in this room would oppose, is through the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted in the light of the original intent of those who framed and ratified it. Now, the Constitution's, the idea of original intent, I think can only be, and I'll say up front, the only way it can be defended is by recognizing that the security given to slavery in the Constitution of 1857 was a necessary compromise, but a compromise based upon the recognition that slavery was an evil, but in certain respects a necessary evil, and that if these compromises had not been made and the Constitution had not been adopted, slavery would have been in a much stronger position in America than it was with the adoption of the Constitution. That defense of the Constitution, however, which was Lincoln's defense of the Constitution, is not made by Bork or any of the conservative critics of the liberalism. For example, Chief Justice Rehnquist, in his essay on a living constitution, the living constitution being the liberals' constitution, Justice Rehnquist wrote that if a people adopts a constitution with safeguards for individual liberty, these do indeed take on a certain moral rightness or goodness. They do so neither because of any intrinsic worth or anyone's ideas of natural justice, but only because they have been adopted by a people. Now, first of all, to say that safeguards for individual liberty do not have any intrinsic worth is to say that individual liberty does not have any intrinsic worth for individual life. That to say that if a people adopts these safeguards, they take on a certain moral rightness or goodness means, of course, that they do not have any moral rightness or goodness, but the illusion of moral rightness or goodness is produced by the agreement that the people have when they make that adoption. This, of course, has nothing in common with the idea that all men are created equal and that the rights the rights of individual liberty are rights with which we have been endowed by our Creator. And that these rights, which means, of course, that the interpretation of these rights must be consistent with the idea which one ascribes to the Creator in endowing us with these rights. That's the way in which Lincoln interpreted it. That's not the way in which Mr. Rehnquist does. But the crowning indignity, I must say, of this passage in Rehnquist's essay is the fact that the Constitution has, in addition to great safeguards for individual liberty, it has great safeguards for slavery. But on the basis of his premises, the safeguards for slavery take on the same moral rightness and goodness as the safeguards for liberty. Now, it just happens that that is precisely the position that the South took in 1860 and 61. The most profound reason for secession was not any technicalities in the discussion of the status of slavery in the territories. The most profound reason was that the South refused to remain fellow citizens of another part of the country, or another country, as they saw it, which condemned an institution which they found fundamental to their well-being. President Buchanan, in his last speech, his annual State of the Union speech, his last State of the Union speech, said that unless the free states repealed their personal liberty laws, nothing could prevent the South from seceding. Now, the personal liberty laws were laws that eight of the free states had passed in the 1850s designed to prevent free Negroes from being carried off into slavery on the ground that they were runaway slaves. The Fugitive Slave Law, which was a very cruel law, provided that any slave owner could go, say, from Virginia into Pennsylvania and claim a certain black man as his runaway slave. If he did that, this man had to be incarcerated and a federal commissioner appointed, who would then have a hearing in which the slave owner could summon witnesses, but the slave, the one accused of being a slave, could not. He had no legal representation and no ability to call witnesses. In response to this, a number of the free states passed laws attempting to put state intervention into the prevent the enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Law in such a way that free men were not carried off into slavery. But this was so offensive to the South that they were demanding its repeal. And the President of the United States took the side of the South and called for the repeal of these personal liberty laws. This gives you an idea of the state of opinion. And there was nothing that made the Southern leaders and many of the Southern people more angry than the idea that an institution which they now felt to be a positive good was regarded as an evil. There's no question but at the time of the founding, the judgment of slavery as an evil was universal. I don't know any important document which, there were plenty of defenses of the interests of slavery, there were no defenses of the morality of slavery. But this had changed in the 1820s and 30s. And just as Rehnquist's account of how safeguards for how the way in which the adoption of a law is the thing that made it moral. There was no intrinsic morality, no question of intrinsic morality, either with regard to liberty or to slavery. And Rehnquist's argument justifies the South's position in 1860. Now, it's important to realize that the great bulwark to liberal constitutionalism is the belief that the Constitution was a racist document, and that it was one that gave approval, moral approval to slavery. In 1987, at the time of the celebration of the 200th anniversary of the Constitution, Justice Thurgood Marshall made a great public statement to the effect that he would not celebrate a Constitution which was racist. And he was followed in this by Justice Brennan, I'm sure a great many other liberals who looked down upon the Constitution as a racist document. It's not possible, it seems to me, to defend the Constitution by, in effect, agreeing with the liberals as to the character of the Constitution. And that is the difficulty which faces us as conservatives. We are saddled with a conservative jurisprudential army, so to speak, which is only fueling the fires of liberalism and then complaining that the liberals keep winning their war with the conservatives. Now, I just wanted to give one other example of conservative jurisprudence. See if I can find. I'm sure you'll all be all delighted to know that the next target for me is Justice Scalia. I have a chapter in my book on the storm over the Constitution, which the title is the whole theory of democracy, in quotes. Antonin Scalia, meet James Madison and friends. Here is Justice Scalia in his interview at the Gregorian University in Rome. This is 1996. It seems to me incompatible with democratic theory that it's good and right for the state to do something that the majority of the people do not want done. Once you adopt democratic theory, it seems to me you accept the proposition. If the people, for example, want abortion, the state should permit abortion. If the people do not want it, the state should be able to prohibit it. Now, if you substitute the words slavery for abortion, you've got precisely the position of Stephen A. Douglas in the debates with Abraham Lincoln. But you can see the reflection of the same attitude that Rehnquist has, that whether you adopt the thing or not depends upon whether it's moral or not. It's only immoral not to do what the people want. He says, the whole theory of democracy is that the majority rules. That is the whole theory of it. You protect minorities only because the majority determines that there are certain minority positions that deserve protection. And again, you either agree with democratic theory or you do not. But you cannot have democratic theory and then say, but what about the minority? The minority loses. Now, pure majority rule, the only institutional example of what is meant by pure majority rule is the plebiscite, which was invented by Napoleon and has since been used effectively by Hitler and Stalin. Most recently, I think the last general election that Saddam Hussein called, he got 99% of the vote, which I think is better even than Hitler and Stalin. But obviously, an election without freedom of speech, freedom of the press, or freedom of assembly is not a legitimate expression of popular will. The popular will must be conditioned by the recognition of minority rights. And in fact, the idea of minority rights is not itself is insufficient. There are no, strictly speaking, there are no minority rights. There are only individual rights. Individual rights which everyone has and which the majority is designed to protect. It's because everyone has the same rights which the same Constitution is designed to protect that the majority can trust the minority. The minority can accept the rule of the majority. But Mr. Scalia, and by the way, I've been teaching political philosophy for more than half a century, and I've yet to find a book that he read that told him that majority rule is the whole theory of democracy. Maybe I'll find out where that book was. But as far as I know, the first person to use the plebiscite as a source of legitimacy without any restrictions on the government conducting the election was Napoleon. By the way, an episode in our political history in 1945 when the Potsdam Treaty was held. And the first part of that meeting, Winston Churchill represented the British government, the wartime prime minister. But some weeks earlier, Britain had held a general election, but the ballot boxes were not opened until after the soldier vote had been collected. And when he went to Potsdam and he met Stalin, he said that he might not be here very long because he didn't know what the results of the election would be. So Stalin asked him, who controls the ballot boxes? And Churchill said, well, the government did. So Stalin laughed and laughed and laughed. I mean, you have the ballot boxes and you don't know who's going to win? So that of course, it's difficult to understand how people as elevated in our society and with presumably the best education should be so ignorant of the simplest elements of political science, certainly dealing with the idea of free government. To say that the minority depends upon the goodwill of the majority for their rights is simply inconsistent with any form of constitutionalism. Yet these are the people whom we look to, and I must say that I myself generally agree with what Justice Scalia and Justice Rehnquist say about particular cases, but their wisdom about day-to-day matters of jurisprudence or judging cases is an example of what Leo Strauss called retail sanity, but with wholesale madness. And unless we can attain a higher level of sophistication simply in the conservative movement, which at this time seems, as far as I can tell, follows the lead of Rehnquist and Scalia and Bork, we will not be able to straighten out our constitutionalism and regain the Constitution which Abraham Lincoln saved in 1861 and 65. Thank you.